that the Morgan character is how Lois and Jimmy get hooked up with Hawkins, the stool pigeon.
Oh, yeah. And he comes back for several episodes.
He comes back, he gets a free lunch out of the deal. Remember
Yeah, of course. Yeah, of course.
that? I loved that. I thought it was so great. He was like, Lois comes to him and he, I hear you got some information. He's like, yeah, well, I was looking to get a meal. And she's like, okay. It cracked me up, man. The next scene that cuts to him like walking out of the restaurant, like patting his belly, and he's got a toothpick in his mouth. And he's like, all right, now that I've had my sandwich, here's the scoop.
Here's the scoop. Yeah, no, it's you're not getting anything out of me before I get a hot hammy in my tummy.
Hey man, it's understandable,
It is. It is. I've been hungry, you know. Hey, listen, Trish and I were just talking last night about our honeymoon trip to Universal Studios, and it was near the end of our stay. And we had, we were barely not kids, and we had no money, but we went anyway. And one of the things that we happened into, they were offering free salads if you wanted to taste test these Wendy's salads. And so we were starving, and we were like, "Yep, we're gonna taste test your salads." And of course, they were like, "You don't have to eat the entire thing. This is just," and we're just shoveling these salads. And we're like, "What? No, this is great. You got more? You want us to try another one?"
Yeah.
And then they gave us like coupons for free Wendy's food, and so we used those on the way home to not starve on the way home too. So I get where he's coming from. Is what I'm saying is that you want to be fed, and I will take your salad survey, Lois Lane, if you need me to rat out the spider lady to you. That's what I'm saying.
Are we sponsored by Wendy's now? What just
I don't know.
happened?
It's either we're sponsored by Wendy's or by Universal Studios, but the point is that the promise of free food will get information out of you.
Gotcha, gotcha. You've been
Oh
podcasting all day. Are you hungry, Dan? Do we need to give you a sandwich before we
no,
continue?
I'm just saying I understand his motivations,
I know, I'm just messing with
Give
you,
me a
buddy.
sandwich, I'll give you some
Look, up in the sky, it's a bird.
Josh,
Dan,
and
Superman!
Hey everybody, welcome back to the show. And I can say that now. I can say welcome back because we've done multiples of these.
On a consistent basis.
Yeah, man. It's a thing now.
It is.
Welcome back to Josh, Dan, and Superman. I am the Josh of that equation and joined as always.
Boom, boom, boom. I'm Dan.
Dan
And
Decker. How you doing,
that's me.
Dan?
I'm doing great, man. It's a great week. A lot of big things happening this week, but this particular assignment, this mission we chose to accept, turned out to be quite a bit of different adventure than I anticipated going in. We should probably clue the readers in on what we're talking about.
What we did is we went all the way back to the very beginning. This is the Superman serial of 1948, starring Kirk Allen as Superman. Now, I think last episode I actually called him Rick Allen, so I'm
It's
gonna go
Kirk.
ahead.
Kirk
Yeah,
Allen.
it's Kirk Allen, not Rick Allen. So sorry about that.
Never gonna give you up. Never gonna let you down.
And I think, we should give credit where credit is due. I learned about this from a tweet from one of our listeners. Robert Olson on Twitter
Oh,
asked if
yeah.
we were ever going to do, the Superman series with Kirk Allen. I had to look it up real quick. I didn't even know they existed. So, shout out to Robert Olson. Thanks for
And also Rob is one of the cast and players on DS9 Pod. So another Trek nerd, exciting adventure that you can go on if you're not into Superman, which I don't understand why you're here and hearing this if you're not. But if that's the case and you happen to also but want to also be into D&D, you can check out the DS9 Pod. But yeah, Rob's a good dude, and I I had memory of this, but it's also easy for me to admit that that memory may be conflated with elements of the 1950s TV series with Reeves. There are elements of this that I had memory of, but overall it was like an old fresh take on our favorite Man of Steel.
Yeah, it was brand new to me. This is a brand new experience. I had a blast with it. We found the on archive.org. We found the place to stream it. They just kind of put it together as a feature, and it was over 4 hours long.
So take that, Snyder.
Yeah, I assumed that this was the 1948 serial included with the 1950 serial, the sequel that comes after it. And about halfway through, I was like, so maybe the first one's a little bit longer than the second one. And then, I'm 3 hours in and I'm like, I don't think the second one is on here.
Yeah, we thought we might tackle, turns out what is 9 hours of Superman film rather than 4 hours of Superman film. So the serials, for those who are just aware of them as we were a series of 15 episodes of 18 minutes in length. And they were released weekly along with a matinee feature. So back in the day, kids, the way they got you to come back for the movies is by hooking you with the serials, right? So you can imagine that you might not always want to go weekly to see a new film, but if there is a new adventure of your favorite superhero, say Flash Gordon or Superman, you might be enticed to go back and watch that matinee over again or watch a movie you have no other interest in if it's got the next installment of The Adventures of Superman on it.
And what a... It's something that's lost today. Mm-hmm. We don't do this anymore with the advent of the TV, obviously. We can watch these episodes in the comfort of our living room. But what a fun thing, I mean, the first three were included with feature films.
Yeah.
So that's how they hooked you. You went to see the latest Western or whatever, and you got, this 18-minute little episode of Superman. And then, like you said, they would release them, week after week. And I just think it's so fun. It's like going to the movies used to be an event.
Right. Absolutely. And now what do we get before the film? We get, 87 minutes of trailers that spoil what they're trailing. And then,
commercials.
Yeah. And it used to be all the commercials were before the movie, or before the trailers. And then you got the trailers and there were maybe four of them, and they were relevant to the interest of the film you were there to see. And then you got the movie. But we don't get that anymore. And what I think, too, is what's kind of interesting is how, these serials were the way the serialized storytelling format has come back around again. Everything old is new again. Obviously, like you mentioned, this serialized storytelling led to the same thing happening in television. Eventually we got TV, but television became episodic versus serialized for decades, and now we've come back around to a serialized way of storytelling. And there
it's
isn't
funny.
Really there isn't an episode of this 1948 film that you can miss. They're all jam-packed with they ran 18 minutes when they were presented, and that's with bookends of playing the first minute and a half, I think. For contrast, I ended up with trouble through the archive.org file. And so instead of just fighting that, I went and got they're available on Amazon. You can get all 30 episodes. It's split into Superman 1948 and Adam Man versus Superman 1950. And so you can get the whole kit for $25 on Amazon. It's also available on Apple TV. But with that, they're broken into the episodic format. So you get the title cards and the voiceover, which is just fantastic. And you get the lead-in from the previous episode. So about the first minute and a half or so of the next installment is the last minute and a half of the previous episode.
Yeah, like previously, you know, on.
Yeah, and yeah. I mean, yeah, and it's that is literally what it is. And so if you watch them cut together like that, like you mentioned, you said you could kind of feel where the breakpoints were. But even then, you know, watching them back to back to back as it cuts from one to the next, it's a little bit jarring because it feels like you've gone back. You know, did I rewind?
Yeah. Wait a minute. Did I see this already?
I've already seen this. But it's a, you know, and aside from just the format of it, there's a lot about this that was incredibly surprising to me. And, you know, we chatted back and forth about the things that stood out along the way. But you noted from the beginning, like literally the beginning of the story, where that's where the similarities began, and some of those elements of the origin that we see here are the origin that we continue to see today. So many of those elements continue. I mean, almost line for line, beat for beat. you could take the beginning of this and set it next to the beginning of 1978 and set it next to the beginning of Man of Steel, and it all carries forward, you know?
Yeah, that's the first thing that struck me, was just how unchanged that whole origin story is with Jor-El on Krypton, and he's trying to explain to the panel that, you know, or not the panel, but, you know, the other Kryptonians that we have used our planet up. And, you know, they're all like, you're full of crap, Jor-El. It's the same story.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty much like you said, beat for beat.
Well, the way, not only the elements of the story, but how it's told, it translates forward so well that, I mean, the special effects are of their time, obviously, what they could do in 1948. I think they did a lot of, they put a lot of their effects budget into this first episode. we get some really quite elaborate for the time sets on Krypton. You know, the capsule, his queer little ship is pretty cool. And you know, the destruction of Krypton, with the volcano and the eruptions and, everything quite impressive given, the limitations they were under. But the end of Krypton is where we get our first indication of the true special nature of these special effects.
Yeah, well, I think a lot of that too was stock footage that they were cutting to, with like the volcano and the lava and all that.
Oh, yeah,
thing.
Yeah.
They couldn't have actually done that.
I think there was some element of it looked like a set, like, you know, maybe a fourth grader's volcano project for science class.
It was all cut together with stock footage and miniatures, and then, you know,
economical just storytelling techniques.
Yeah, exactly. And it, I mean, you know, at the time, I'm sure it was great. You know, notice it now. Yeah. You know,
well, but I imagine bet, you know, being 7, 8, 9 years old and having read, you know, a couple of Superman books off the rack. And then, you know, you show up for your favorite Next Western or whatever it is, and this is what you see. And I can just imagine, you know, how easily your young mind will fill in the gaps, you know, with the special effects, or the, you know, the, just your imagination will fill the voids. And I mean, mine did, and I'm 46 when I was watching this. And so I could just imagine going back and not giving a rip about the way it looked overall as a small child, and just being, you know, struck by the fact that you're watching Superman on the big screen.
After the planet blows up, you said you were going to mention something there. What did you want to talk about?
Oh, the special nature of the special effects. The first time I saw it, I thought, wow, that is really kind of clever. But they're animated. They're mixed animation. So the animation is mixed in with the live action or the stock footage, as the case may be. And you know, Krypton blows up in kind of this little, you know, puff of little animated cloud.
Yeah, and then we see the spaceship, the animated spaceship.
Oh, like, and yeah, and it animates. It's all the way in, and you know, it even has the kind of the sparkly zip that we're used to seeing when it comes to Superman traveling from Krypton to Earth. It lands, our little capsule lands in Kansas, as it often does.
to, as it's known to do,
to our very well known adoptive parents of Superman, Eben and Martha Kent.
Wait a minute, Eben?
Eben, what did you say?
I could have sworn his name was Jonathan.
I had to look it up. I had to go back and know what the heck, because I my ears were like, they said Eben. And I went back and I heard it again. And I was like, is Eben even a name?
I've never heard of an Eben. I've never met an Eben.
And so, but I did. I went and so, you know, Wikipedia'd a few things to kind of figure out so we could, you know, kind of speak to this somewhat intelligently. And it turns out, that the adoptive parents' names were not solid and fully canonized until almost the mid-50s.
With the Superboy comic books.
Mm-hmm, yeah, and it became Martha and Jonathan. There was even a time where it was Mirtha. And I think she's been married before. But Eben and Jonathan were, I don't know if they're interchangeable, but those were the two more common names for Pa Kent, you know, or Pa Kent. Ma and Pa were seemed to be the more go-to before they were given, you know, official names. But what struck me in the way they were doing this too is that there was an attention to detail that I did not anticipate when it came to keeping things with contemporary. And so, you know, based on what we know of the Superman story, he goes out into the world and starts to begin his works, you know, parallel to someone else at about the age of 30, 33, right? And so you frame that back to the landing, it would have been 1918 from 1948 that he landed on Earth. And they go back, you know, if you watch the Kents, they arrive in a period accurate vehicle. It's like a Model T truck. Then flash forward to Metropolis when Clark is going out into the world. And, you know, it's contemporary vehicles, 1940s, mid-40s style vehicles and such. And I thought, wow, that is, you know, someone was thinking about that even then when they were, you know, just trying to make this movie for what they could get away from making it for. They took the time to think about those kinds of things, too, which was rather impressive to me.
It is impressive, and I also think it goes to show you how much of an important character Superman has been to us all along. Mm-hmm. You know, this character spoke to people even way back then when they knew they'd probably get away with, you know, not using the period correct cars and stuff like that. But someone cared enough about the character and the story to put effort into it.
Right,
and I think it's great. You
know? Well, and something. And I almost gave you credit for it, but I don't think it was you. I'm pretty sure it was Jake, future co-host, guest co-host on the show, Jake Hood, Final Frontier 87 on Twitter, pointed out about, you know, and that broad appeal of Superman pointed out how, he was a turn on Nietzsche's, Ubermensch. And from the domineering and dominating ideal of that, and to have that idea turned around and turned into the ideal of Superman, who is the every person immigrant created by two Jewish sons of immigrants to represent all of us, you know, rather than the best one of us. He's meant to represent the best all of us. And I think that's part of that.
Yeah, it was Jake. We spoke about that too over DMs, and that's pretty high thinking. I couldn't come up with a concept like that.
Oh man, so, Jake loves some Superman. I mean, you know, there's a reason he might be our first big, you know, double sized annual issue, but not likely the last.
yeah, I can't wait to have him on the show, Jake. If you're listening, yeah,
oh, we know you're listening, brother.
Coming soon.
But again, you know, we talked about it, and not quite to the same refined level. You know, they were just making these serials for fun, obviously wanting to make some money too at the same time, but. You know, the shortcuts to storytelling we talked about in like Man of Steel, where, you know, in this, yes, it's campy. Yes, it's a little forced, but it's still quasi-expositional natural dialogue rather than, you know, and as you know, we, you know, Eben rescues baby Kal-El out of the spacecraft, and it's like, oh, he appears to be wrapped in some sort of fireproof blankets. He's not harmed at all, you know? And then, I don't know, when the conversation that they have to Clark, it's like, it's the most awkward puberty conversation you've ever heard. When it comes to Martha and Pa Kent, Ma and Pa Kent letting Clark in on his secret and out into the world.
But it's also, they're having it with Kirk Allen, who they didn't try to de-age or anything. He's a 37-year-old man sitting in his living room in a full suit, you know.
Ready to go out in the world, yeah.
Yeah, you know, and I do. I love that scene though, because I almost said Jonathan, but Eben just goes, you know, it's time to talk to you, son.
Yes. The way, you're going to start noticing some changes down there.
You know what's funny? I was reading an article that pointed out one of the things that he says to Clark is because of these great powers, your super strength, your speed, your X-ray vision, and super sensitive hearing, you have a great responsibility, and that's 15 years prior to Amazing Spider-Man.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Great power it's comes true. Great responsibility.
It is Jonathan Kent been teaching the Uncle Ben lesson. Since the beginning,
Yeah.
It is a fun, awkward moment. But what gets me is that, like, you know, Clark's sitting there reading the newspaper. Jonathan or Eben's sitting there smoking his pipe. And Martha just suddenly has this realization, like, oh, shit, we got to tell him before he goes. She, like, eggs him on. And he's like, oh, yes, of course, dear. And he gets up and he paces with his pipe. And as you know, Clark, you have these strange and magical, wonderful powers. But then the next thing is, like, he's like, you're right, Dad, and so I'll just go into the world and become a reporter. You know, just name it and claim it, Clark. Name it and claim it, brother. You know?
And then Martha comes along and she's like, you know, and also I've made this suit for you. It came in the blanket that you were swaddled in, and it's impervious to acid and fire.
I mean, yes. Okay, so, you know, it is ham-fisted. But again, you know, in the sense of it, she's exposing him to this information for the first time along with us. So it isn't, and as you know, Clark, you arrived in these acid fireproof clothes. I made you a suit. but what got me is, and I can't wait to, you know, the beautiful thing about Superman is there's so much of it and we have so much to celebrate. But I was rewatching pilot of Superman and Lois, and after having seen that part, and you know, he does the rescue scene, and the kid's like, "Nice outfit," and he's like, "Cool, you know, thanks, my mom made it for me."
Yeah.
Oh, that was just because I had, like, just the day before had been the hits acid resistant and fireproof. Oh, this is amazing! Such a good.
Let's not get up on too much of a tangent, but I do want to say that. I am absolutely loving Superman and Lois.
Yeah, just one of those through lines that we keep, you know, that keeps us tied together. The threads of the cape, as it were.
Did you notice that when Clark does, like, pack his suitcases and head off to Metropolis to get his reporting job, that in the voiceover it just kind of nonchalantly just drops that the parents died?
Oh, did I miss that? Holy crap. And on on the way back to his home planet, Poochie's spaceship blew up and he was never heard from ever again.
Yeah, exactly. No, there's a little voiceover between when he's, like, traveling to Metropolis, and the voiceover just, like, you know, and after his parents passed away, it's like, whoa, wait a minute, what?
So presumably, I don't know if you had to go get some sort of journalistic credentials before, but apparently in 1948 Metropolis, you walk into Perry White's office and tell him you work for him now.
Yeah, you basically, he still has his suitcases with him.
Yeah, two of them, by the way.
He just walks into the office like, hey, bud. I don't have a job and I don't got a place to stay, but you're going to hire me.
Listen, never written a word in my life, buddy, but I'm your ace reporter. But no, the best part was, like the setup is Perry's receptionist is literally telling like an important person, Mr. White's not taking any calls right now. And you know, Clark walks in and he's like, I'm here to see the editor. He's not taking any calls right now. He'll see me.
Gosh darn it.
Because I can see him. I have X-ray vision, you know. Oh, no. Wait. So I'm going to do the Superman voice this entire podcast.
That's fine.
I can't help but do the over-exaggerated 1948 announcer voice during this entire thing.
I wish that I wish that we could get jobs like Clark got, man. I mean, you and I, we could just march in and I don't know where we go.
Yeah, no, we could, the White House. Listen here, Joe Biden.
We're going to be doing podcasts for a living now. Well, and you're going to like
listen,
it.
That's right. Listen, we're shaking things up around here, buddy. Get on out of here. You're on your keister. We need old fashioned. Bring back old fashioned slang. Well, and the cool thing about old fashioned slang is just like Southern slang, you can make shit up on the fly, and no one knows you're making it up.
You know? Yeah, exactly.
Well, that smells worse than a coon shit under a hot rubber tire. You don't know that we don't say that.
Good grief! Oh, to be, you know. A lot of people out there might have wished that they were good old Southern boys until they listen to this podcast and they're like, maybe not.
These guys are Southern and Superman. That's all we got.
Did you notice when going back to before you got to Metropolis, there was the reference? Well, I guess maybe the 1978 movie was referencing this when he fixes the railroad track.
Oh, there was so that's one of the things that I'm so glad you brought that up because yes, it's that there's a couple of those moments where it like you said, it is these parts of the story that show that we're familiar enough with that help us understand his powers. And having that as a callback, you know, obviously Donner knew more about the previous history of Superman in film than we did because he knew to
imagine that.
He knew to draw these parallels, no pun intended when it comes to train tracks. But yeah, and a great bit. He's like, it doesn't have to be true to anything. It's ready to be spiked right now.
and
so great.
I don't know if Zack Snyder was referencing it, but at the beginning of this film, he saves Eben from a tornado.
He does, yes.
But he actually saves him, though.
Yeah, you know? Right. And that was another one that I noticed. I was like, so, you know, and it is, I'm glad that we kind of stumbled into this one last. Honestly, it would have been, I think it would have done a disservice to have started here, you know, even though it was first. We're able to both kind of celebrate and appreciate it as the first thing where we see its legacy in the things we know now, right?
Yeah.
And which is great. And one of the things that I read, and you know, the reason that I think a lot of it was a surprise more to you and I is that Kirk Allen was uncredited in this, and the marketing was, we couldn't find anyone to play Superman, so we hired Superman. And so they didn't want to bill the actor playing Superman as part of the trope of the mythos, right? But Kirk Allen played Clark Kent. But you know, that we get the opportunity here to bring it up and hopefully share that with fans who didn't know or new fans who are learning about for the first time. Super great, super great.
It kind of sucks for Kirk Allen. I mean, maybe he was just kind of in on it and, you know, understood it for the project. But can you imagine like landing a role, you know, like Superman and be like, but we're not going to tell anybody it's you. Your name's not going to be anywhere.
Oh,
on
man.
This.
Yeah, no, that would have done, you know. Yeah. No, Chris, you don't get to tell anyone you're in the movie, buddy.
How's that? Yeah.
What again? But played it very well. The villain, though, the caper, as it were, the reducer Ray, Some high science. This is some high science.
Yes, it is. It's very, very high science.
I think they
science.
Smoked weed and then they came up with the science behind the reducer ray.
It looks like a big light bulb.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's a very powerful, compact, fluorescent light bulb that apparently disrupts molecular structure to a pretty severe degree.
It reduces rays, bro.
It's not a reducer ray, it reduces rays, right? But the spider lady, man, I don't even know, like, where did that come from? She's not a typical Superman villain. It's not one we're familiar with, I don't think.
I never heard of her before, and I don't think I've heard of her since. Spider lady.
she had an ignominious fate, though, you know, speaking of reducer rays.
Yeah,
spoiler
but
alert.
I mean, I, it was one of the things I said to you. I kind of feel like she dropped the ball when she was picking her name. I mean, she started out strong with the spider, you know, and then
lady.
Just kind of fell flat with the lady, you know.
But she, you know, she had your Domino mask to let you know she's evil. But more importantly, she had mask henchmen, someone specifically there to remove the mask.
And they all wore the same tie. Did you notice that?
No, and not only that, but they all wore the same frumpy dump, you know, short tie, wide short tie, which I never understood how those were popular in the 40s and 50s. But yeah, all of the henchmen had the dumpy ties, and all of the people you could trust had actual regular full length ties. They wore the same. It's like the tie is part of the uniform, you know.
But she doesn't reference spiders except for that, you know, she's got the web.
She's got, yeah.
But other than that, it's not like she's not like the Penguin where he has a bunch of penguins.
Yeah, no, she really dropped the ball on the motif other than the web.
That's what I'm saying, man. She started out strong. She chose spider and she should have ran with it.
Yep.
You know?
No,
she should have attacked Metropolis with a, I don't know, what do you call a gaggle of spiders?
Yeah, that works for a gaggle of spiders. It's an unfortunate misstep on her part. You know, I think she had the beginnings of a plan. And as she says in one of the episodes, not if it's a plan that I've just devised now. Well, I think that's where your problem is, Spider-Lady. Yeah. Is that
you
your plans
think this
are just
through.
Kind of like, you know, on the fly, as it were, and the fly is not in your spider web. Oh,
I want to know, what does she want to do with the reducer ray once she gets it?
Evil.
Evil.
Evil. Evil for the sake of evil. I mean, what else do villains want to do but be vile?
I guess. I thought maybe she'd have some motivation or something.
Again,
but
we fall back to the lack of proper planning on her part.
Yeah.
It's like
the
underpants gnomes. They don't know what step two is, but by God, we're getting to profit. It's like reducer spider lady, step two, reducer ray. I don't know.
Doesn't make any sense to me either, but it's evil.
It's evil. Sounds evil. Destruction. We'll blow stuff up. By the way, though, Metropolis portrayed by the city of Los Angeles in this film.
The city of Los Angeles and then the back lot, I think.
Yeah,
in
the back lot.
I think of Warner Brothers.
How many times
Brothers.
They need to be in a cave or a mine.
Or how many times a street curves at the end and you can't see the end of it. It's obviously the back lot, you know.
Right.
and the storefronts, I noticed the storefronts are all just completely generic. It was like liquor
store. There's radios.
Radios, yeah.
Radios. The good old-fashioned days where you could go down to the corner store and buy a radio.
Yeah.
To keep up with all the happenings.
But one thing, going back to Spider Lady real quick, I think it's pretty interesting that this is the 1940s and the lead villain was a female.
Absolutely.
You know, correct me if I'm wrong, but that seems kind of forward thinking for the time.
So we'll get there, dear readers. We like we mentioned in the beginning, we intended or anticipated that the four and a half hour marathon that we endeavored to complete was both the 48 and the 50 serial. However, it's just the 48 serial. I did get to the first couple episodes of the 1950 serial involving Lex and Atom Man, and the tone was immediately different. And I sent you a message about it, but Whereas this was very, women power. There isn't a lot of sexism. There isn't a lot of misogyny. The second one starts almost straight away with, look at that. Of course it's a woman driver, terrible women drivers, and just leans right into these sexist and misogyny. Yeah, no, it was like two guns blazing, brother. But that's not how it was played in this. Lois is not a damsel in distress. Lois is in trouble because she's Lois Lane, not because she's a woman. as she shows up at the mine when the miners get trapped, she shows up and the cop's like, who are you? And she's like, demon reporter Lois Lane, I'm getting into this mine. And she's like, yeah. No, you're not. And she's like, yeah, nope, gonna get in.
She goes head first into
a mine, a literal mine.
Yeah, well, into pretty much every situation that she gets into. I mean, she is dead set. She's going to go out and get her story. She has real big, I don't need no man energy. Noelle Neal, that's her name, right?
Yep. Mm-hmm. And, what I liked, too, though, was that, she went in after the story and then ended up, being in trouble herself, but not because she went in to get the story. She got herself in trouble because she tried to help the people who were hurting, right?
Yeah, that's what I was just gonna say that. That's why she got herself into trouble, was because she was trying to help all the miners out. Yep.
What I did catch, though, is that they all wear the same costume through the entire thing, and this takes place over weeks. I think maybe days, but
yeah,
but
I noticed that too.
Where Lois wears the exact same outfit every time, just like you would in a comic book.
Specifically because of the hat that she wears. That thing is great hat. That's a big hat.
It's a totally great hat. It's the hat and I do like that outfit. Now, not to harp too much on that, but I do like that outfit. And I want to take a moment to take off on just a hair of a tangent, because I know we're going to talk about Superman and Lois, and I know you have your questions about that character in that show, but I think that There's a through line between Noelle Neal's version of the character and the modern take in that show. I'm just going to leave that for a later discussion.
Yeah, well, you had mentioned that to me, and I'm going to be watching Superman and Lois through different eyes now. I'm going to try to make that connection with this version of the character.
I really like her as Lois, like Noelle Neal. I think she's great. Obviously, the first Lois on film has a lot of sway, but she got a chance to define the character for the very first time in a live action context, and that is and I think she did a very good job. They let her do a very good job.
I think she did too. And what I think is interesting is there is no love interest whatsoever between her and Clark.
Nope.
It's actually like, refreshing. They're racing to get the story first. So they're almost,
yes, exactly.
They're colleagues, but at the same time, there is some pushback with them. They're trying to get there first,
Well, somehow. She is nothing. The way it played to me is that she is nothing but competitive. Clark plays his confidence because he's not. That was the one thing when he went charging in to get his job from Perry. I was like, mild mannered my ass.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, he doesn't diminish Lois in any way. He treats her as an equal. Treats her like she's a pain in his ass more than anything, really.
Well, she is a pain in his ass.
Yeah, and right.
I mean, there's that one point where they're going off together, riding in the car, and she's like, "Oh, sounds like a flat," and he's like, "I don't hear anything." She's like, "No, you need to get out and check it." And he gets out of the car, and then she just takes off.
Yep.
Yeah, leaves him in the desert.
Yep.
Like, damn, Lois.
I'm getting my story, and then they both, as fighting parents do, they play Jimmy against the middle. Poor fella.
Poor guy.
he's drug, and I don't know how old that actor was, but boy, they really didn't de-age him much either. Here, put on this trilby and a bow tie, and you're 17.
Yeah, but he didn't have a camera. That's what I never understood.
Yeah, they play him as a cub reporter, not a photographer. So he's a junior reporter learning the beat from Lois in this rather than the staff photographer for the Daily Planet. So that was one thing I noted. And another one of those interesting things. So he's played more as a colleague you know, a junior colleague than a junior person to our two stalwart reporters of the Daily Planet. Speaking of, one thing that continued to stand out to me every time was the Daily Planet fleet cars. Sometimes they were labeled, you know, nicely, and sometimes it was like, it's still wet, but we got a whole film.
Yeah, I noticed that too.
Piece of paper plastered to the side of the car.
It looks like they just kind of just duct taped it on there too. Oh, yeah. Like half,
I mean,
like
I don't even know
off.
If they use duct tape, you know. But yeah, it's the way they play off of each other is more about professional than it is about love interest, which I don't know where the comics were at that time with regard to that whole angle. It's the least interesting dynamic to play between Clark and Lois and Superman. The love angle, we all know where it ends up because that's just how the story is going to play. So it's nice to not have that be any part of the story because, well, first of all, we got the Spider Lady to contend with. You can't get distracted by love.
Yeah. And the Spider Lady, her plan, like we said earlier, like, I'm not real sure what she wants to do with this reducer ray, but she wants it really bad.
She wants control of it. She wants all the formulas that control it. She wants the guy who made it, which that poor fella, they tortured him.
Yeah, he has a... He goes through a rough time in this show. It's Dr. Graham.
Yeah, he gets rough go of it.
Yeah, that's actually where I was heading. I wanted to talk about Dr. Graham a little bit.
Poor guy.
This poor guy, you know, he creates this destructive force. And he seems like an okay guy. But then I guess he's assuming it's going to be used for good or, you know, for the good old US of A.
I'm not sure what level of, you know, destructive power that this kind of thing has that could be considered for good. But whatever his motivations for having created it, he's very proud of it. And he's not allowed to share it or talk about it with anyone because government. He went through a lot to keep that secret. And eventually they drug every bit of it out of him. He was a broken man in the end.
Yeah, he definitely was. I thought it was funny that when Spider Lady sent some henchmen to combat the reducer ray when they were testing it out, that theirs was called the negative ray.
Yeah. They had the negative ray, you know, because obviously you just...
cancels out.
Man, and the discovery, we have the discovery of kryptonite. And there's a whole few, like, three episodes about kryptonite.
That's when Lois does the whole thing in the car where she makes Clark get out of the car and drives away. And then Clark's just, you know, walking down the road trying to get home. And this Dr. Leeds guy is the guy that noticed the meteorite and was just off to get it and just happens to be passing by the same road and picks him up.
Yeah. And then he starts, every time he's exposed to kryptonite, he does the, you know, throat tightening, you know, grabs his necktie. We're starting to get warm in here.
I don't feel so hot, guys.
Well played, though. And one of the things, too, though, that cracks me up is anytime, you know, it's intense stare in the narrow to be like, so because, you know, we're not sure what version of intense stare we're seeing. And so the narrator makes sure to tell us Superman uses his supersonic hearing or he's X-ray vision. And then you get special
once test. Again, Superman uses his X-ray vision.
So good.
I like that. And every time that he would like fly out of a window or anything like that, there was the voiceover of him going up and away.
Yeah, you have to say that in order. So I've learned unless he says up and away, then he's only capable of leaping tall buildings in a single bound. In order to take flight, he must say up and away.
Makes sense. I mean, it makes perfect sense.
Yeah. So how else do you activate your key power? You know, you have to have something, some bouncing off point, right? You don't just fly.
Yeah, and every time he turned into Superman, too, there was that voiceover. Because he never actually said it to the camera or anything. It's just always just a voiceover of him saying, "Looks like a job for Superman."
And I don't even think it was Kirk Allen's voice. I don't think. But that was one of the things that I, you know, when I was doing some background to kind of get a sense for what, how these were made and what the ideology was at the time, is that, you know, they did the animation to save money. And, but, you know, you can see it as it happens. Every time he takes off, it's out of a window or up through the camera. And every time he lands, it's behind something or into a window, because it was making the animated transitions so much easier. And one of the things said that, you know, the animations were repeated a lot. I didn't notice that as much. I didn't really take note to see the same animations over again. But I thought it was a pretty clever way to, you know, get Superman to fly in that time period. And it served a purpose. They use it sparingly, but to great effect, you know. And if you only see it a couple times each episode, you don't really get a chance to focus on it.
Yeah, I did notice one of the repeated animations. It's when he comes back to whenever he comes back to the Daily Planet.
Oh, right.
It was always the same. And yeah, it's actually when it cuts back to live action, it's the same pretty much every time. He shows up in the little closet as Superman. He kind of looks out the door to see if anybody's watching. He steps behind a filing cabinet and, yep, he steps back out as Clark. Yep. And it's the same thing pretty much every time he comes back to.
Well, that plays into that whole, the stock room or the file cabinet room, plays into the 1950s television series too. That's if I recall, that's where, the change action happens there as well.
Huh. That's cool.
We'll find out. We're going to get there.
Yeah. That's next episode.
Boom, boom, boom.
So going back to Dr. Leeds, the guy that finds the kryptonite, first, two things struck me as strange. First, that he knows of Krypton, because he, right, says he thinks it's a, you know, a meteorite from Krypton. So it's like, in this universe, I guess we know about Krypton.
Apparently.
We know about Kryptonians.
Yeah.
So
I don't know about Kryptonians, but they knew it was a planet. Interestingly,
yeah,
we,
yeah,
named it the same thing they did. I think that's helpful.
Yeah.
That's actually the helpful part.
Serendipitous, you,
yeah,
know?
Very much.
But the other thing was, after this whole thing where he falls down the ground and just casually calls somebody and says, Clark Kent's died in my office.
Oh, God.
I loved that too, by the way.
But,
just like,
no,
oh, man.
There was no follow-up on that. Clark is not dead, and nobody ever showed up. Like, the police,
no,
were reported a murder, and they were like, ah, it'll be fine. Well, not a murder, but a death. You know, they're like, ah, it'll be fine.
Someone did show up, though. He was calling his assistant, and his assistant was that Morgan guy who was actually working for Spider Lady.
Because,
okay, remember, he was outside the door listening when,
right,
when Clark tells him that he's Superman. For some reason, that was the other thing I was going to get to. It's like, Superman just picks a random guy and like, hey, buddy, I'm Superman. You know?
By the way, since you can kill me with this rock, I'll let you know.
Yeah.
That is my one weakness as Superman. Yeah.
Yeah, but the Morgan character is how Lois and Jimmy get hooked up with Hawkins, the stool pigeon.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. And he comes back for several episodes.
He comes back, he gets a free lunch out of the deal. Remember,
yeah,
that?
Of course. Yeah, of course.
I loved that. I thought it was so great. He was like, you know, Lois comes to him and he, you know, I hear you got some information. He's like, yeah, well, I was looking to get a meal. And she's like, okay. It cracked me up, man. The next scene that cuts to him, like, walking out of the restaurant, like, patting his belly, and he's got a toothpick in his mouth.
Oh, yeah.
Like, all right, now that I've had my sandwich, here's the scoop.
Here's the scoop. Yeah. No, you know, it's you're not getting anything out of me before I get a hot hammy in my tummy.
Hey, man. It's understandable.
It is. It is. I've been hungry, you know. Hey, listen, Trish and I were just talking last night about our honeymoon trip to Universal Studios, and it was near the end of our stay, and we had you know, we were barely not kids, and we had no money, but we went anyway. And one of the things that we happened into, they were offering free salads if you wanted to taste test these Wendy's salads. And so we were starving, and we were like, yep, we're going to taste test your salads. And, you know, of course they were like, you don't have to eat the entire thing. This is just, and we're just shoveling these salads. And we're like, what? No, this is great. You got more? You want us to try another one? Yeah. And then they gave us like coupons for free Wendy's food. And so we used those on the way home to not starve on the way home too. So I get where he's coming from. Is what I'm saying is that you will, you know, you want to be fed and, you know, I will take your salad survey, Lois Lane, if you need me to rat out the spider lady to you. That's what I'm saying.
Are we sponsored by Wendy's now? What just happened?
I don't know. It's either we're sponsored by Wendy's or by Universal Studios. But the point is that the promise of free food will get information out of you.
Gotcha. You've been podcasting all day. Are you hungry, Dan? Do we need to give you a sandwich before we continue?
Oh, no, I'm just saying. I understand his motivations, you know?
I know. I'm just messing with you.
Give me a sandwich. I'll give you some info.
Okay, so after that, what happens? I think... Is that the first time that Lois gets kidnapped by Spider Lady?
I think so. I don't think Jimmy's... Yeah, she ends up being kidnapped quite a bit.
Yeah. I don't think Jimmy's with her this first time she gets kidnapped, but somebody dies for some reason. They did the special effects with the spider web in her lair.
Oh yes. You know? Oh yeah. Oh yeah. It's totally good. It's the best.
It's all animated. It's the same kind of animation that they use for him flying and stuff, and for mm-hmm. the spaceship in the beginning. You know, the guy just falls into the web, and then all of a sudden you see this like animated electronic, you know, and he's like, and falls down dead.
And not really quite clear what the actual powers of the spider web are. It can somehow draw you into it. I don't know, through typical, you know, the fact, maybe the iron in your blood, who knows, but it can draw you to it at her will. But once it's got you, I'm not sure the mechanism by which you die, but it seems to be quite unpleasant. And true to a good supervillain, the Spider Lady is a gnom de plume. And so, you know, we find out that blonde is not her natural hair color at some point. When she goes to impersonate Lois Lane in order to, a couple of the scientists or someone she's meant to meet with. So she goes instead of Lois and they meet with her and she kidnaps them, as part of it all too. But she's naturally a dark haired lady. The blonde is a wig, you know, and I think that just goes to show her duplicitous nature, honestly.
Yeah, you're right. You know? I think, what you're talking about when she kind of runs Lois off the road and sends the henchmen after him, it's one of many fight scenes out in the desert. Now, I think there were probably about 6 locations mm-hmm. from what I can gather. Mm-hmm. And the desert was definitely used over and over and over. The fight scenes to me were great because they always involved 2 henchmen and Superman showing up to either save Lois or save Jimmy. And he would always kind of do the same thing with the henchmen. He kind of just grab him by the arms and then mm-hmm. tie him up with something.
or he would double knock the heads, you know?
You know, yeah. Katunk. Oh yeah. He did that too.
Yeah. You pick them up, katunk, throw them down, 2 guys out, 1, you know, 2 guys with 1 Superman.
And that's what would incapacitate him, and then he would tie him up with anything that was around. Like that one time he grabbed the bumper off the car, and
because if you're Superman, that's just like twine.
Yeah, I thought it was great though. I mean, it was obviously like a little rubber bumper that they put on the car, but you know, you could tell right away when you pulled it off, it was like flapping around. But then, you know, he ties him up with it. And I was like, that's really cool, man. They did the same thing when Clark was in prison with the prison bars.
Oh, that was
they
were great. Like. Trope too,
you know. Yeah,
my favorite is that he puts them back, you know, he takes the time and he returns and he redresses himself as Clark. He crawls back in bed, but he's taking the time to straighten all of the prison bars, you know. He's not a vagrant. He's not going to graffiti or vandalize, you know. He's Superman.
Well, no, that's government property. He's going to leave it exactly how he found it.
That's right. Even better, probably.
We didn't really talk much about his suit. Mm-hmm. And this is just something, because I was thinking about the fight scenes in the desert. His suit looks to me like it's like a super sweater almost.
It is, you know? Yeah. It's up close, it looks very wool.
Yeah, it looks very thick. And I just wondered, shooting out in the desert, that must have been kind of hot.
Oh, I can only imagine.
Yeah.
I wondered too if it was in the right colors or if it was in grayscale, because it didn't matter.
I read that it was the sweater itself was gray, so everything that was supposed to be blue was gray, and everything that was supposed to be red was brown because it showed up better on black and white film.
Dang! Wow, I'd love to see some set photos of that in color. You know,
really, man, yeah. I would like to. Somebody's probably, has to still own it unless they just threw it away.
Because if
I'd
it was like colorized to today, it would be colorized traditionally. It wouldn't be colorized against the set photos. And I thought about that. I was like, I wonder if it had to be in a different set of colors to show up appropriately on black and white film. But what I like about it is that how much of the suit, how little of the suit has changed over the years. You could almost put Chris Reeve in that suit and not see a whole lot of difference.
Well, there are subtle differences just because of the time frame.
Right. But the S is pretty much the S we still have today. Not quite as angulared, but it is in the more traditional style of the crest that we have these days.
Yeah. The cape was a little bit shorter.
Mm-hmm. I noted that too. It's about the mid of his back thigh than it is down to his knees.
Yeah. And the other difference, of course, is that the trunks are lifted up right under his rib cage.
Yeah, yeah, they're above the waistline. I don't know what we're holding up. you know it is. Superman has super junk. We need super trunks. I don't know.
I did notice. I mean,
he's got a cop piece.
He's got a super package. A couple scenes. It's like, oh, what am I looking at here? Hey,
it's Kirk and Alan. I didn't know you guys were a duo. but I fully loved. I loved every bit of watching these. It's just fun. It was just fun. It felt like watching a comic book, you know. And as we've gotten into modern comic book movie making, you know, everything wants to be grounded in a reality, you know. And it is fun to go back to see these stories being made and being told at a time when it was just to have fun to tell the story. You know, these weren't made to make billions of dollars, right? These were made to tell a fun story about Superman. And yeah. I mean, don't get me wrong. They were made to make money. They were there to drive people to the movies, to get people in the seats, to come back every week. But at the same time, you know, you can tell that they stretched every resource they had to its absolute limit, including the actors, even though they may have not have been the best. They were day actors at best, some of them. But, you know, they stretched every ounce out of the material and the resources they had. And they ended up making a really endearing and, you know, it has stood up remarkably well for something that I didn't really know existed until last week, to my mind, honestly.
Well, and it definitely did the job. You know, it wasn't made to make millions of dollars, but it did. It made $1 million, and that's in 1948 money.
That's, you know, a lot of money.
Yeah,
well, those are real dollars, everyone.
I read, you know, on multiple sites that it's considered to be the most financially successful of all the serials, and that wow. You know, in the time frame from 1915 to 1945, everyone that was made, this is considered, you know, the most successful, and it's I think it's because you, like what you just said, and what we've talked about a couple times in this recording, is it has heart, and you can tell it has heart. You know, it's not the biggest budget in the world. It's not the best actors in the world. It doesn't really have any star power, but the story is just, it's that classic Superman story that we've been drawn to for years. And it goes to show you that even from the beginning, it still had the same impact on people.
Well, I would say too, you know, the most well-defined, strongest character in the entire thing. I mean, even Superman and Clark aren't as well-defined as Lois is in this. Like,
yeah,
the one who's probably, you know, and I would say from the actor's side of it, Noelle had an understanding of Lois that I'm not sure the other actors had of their character, including Kirk. Because his Clark is consistent, but it's not a Clark we know very well. It's not a Clark we're as familiar with, I don't think, these days. But Lois is a lot the same.
Yeah, well, it's like you said at the beginning, he's not mild-mannered. And I think that's one of Clark's, you know, attributes these days, is right. That he's got that shy kind of all shucks thing going on for him. And Kirk Allen definitely didn't have that.
No, and again, I don't know how the character was in the comics then. So, you know, if we had a contemporary lens through which to kind of judge this, it would be one thing. But all we know is what we know of Clark Kent now. And you could even say probably, too, the George Reeve Clark in the 50s TV show is probably slightly less mild-mannered, but he's not as hard-charging. He's a lot more country boy smiley, you know? Charming in that way, where I wouldn't qualify this Clark Kent as charming, really. In a lot of ways, he's not discharming, but he is abrasive. He's a little rough on the edge, you know. But Lois's character feels like Lois Lane.
Yeah, this Clark seems a little like rough and tumble to me. I don't know if that's the right way to explain it.
The 1918 farm is a far cry from the 1950s farm. So,
yeah, you're right.
You know, he would be, we kind of had this conversation, and I think this is a brilliant tactic on your part to kind of cover the opening segments of this endeavor this way, where we, you know, talk about the portrayal by the different actors through the different ages. I keep bringing it up, because I think it's easy for us to forget of Superman in, you know, contemporarily versus Superman, the ageless icon. We continually frame Clark and Superman in 1938 terms, when the character that the most recent version of this character that we have arrived in Earth in 1980, right?
Yeah.
Tyler Hoechlin's character, I'm not sure what year that's set in, but it would be very close to 80-82, based on Superman's age. And that version of Superman may even be older considering the kids. But the point being, you lose sight of something important, I think, if we don't consider the kind of upbringing that Clark would have had in the time that he was brought up. So a farm boy in 1918 would have not been, you know, the mild-mannered, coddled young child that Clark may have been in the 50s, 70s, or 80s. You know, he would have been a lot more hard-nosed, as it were. So probably a lot more confidence. And, you know, who knows? Given the chance to flesh out the way the character came to be and played a couple more times, and maybe we'll find out in Adam Man that he does become more mild-mannered. I don't know. We'll find out.
Well, no, I think you make a good point, and it's a point that I have to say I never really thought of before we started doing this podcast, and it's kind of just come up organically. You know, we try to dissect why each portrayal of the character is portrayed that way, and you know, it only makes sense to go back and look at where they came from and what their lives would have been like. And like you say, like Cavill's Superman, you know, lived through the Cold War and stuff. So of course he's going to have a different outlook. It's a new argument I have to be like, wait a minute, you know,
but Cavill's Superman
you got to think about it. You know, he lived a different life.
Well, and it speaks to the timelessness and the wholesomeness and the at this point almost endemicness of Superman's character, in our modern mythology that we always give him that 1938 benefit of the doubt, that that is that, you know, that pure, wholesome truth, justice, American way, right for right ideal of Superman is the only one we have. Like, it just stands there as the, you know, as the measure. And that's unfair to the character of, you know, that has become Superman, because you got to put it in context. You know, my life has to be put in context. It's not fair for you to judge the me I was against the me I am today, if I'm a better person now, right? And same for Superman. He grew up in a different time. You know, Chris's Superman would have been arrived on Earth the year this serial was in theaters.
Yeah.
So, you know.
Well, I think that what's important to remember about the character of Superman is he always strives to be this version of the character. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. he mm-hmm. strives to be wholesome. He strives to be, you know, to do what's right in every situation, no matter what. He has been put in situations over the years where he kind of has to bend that just a little bit, you know. Yep. And every time he has to bend it, you know, a bunch of people scream that, you know, so-and-so doesn't know the character, or, you know, this and that, Zack Snyder. But, you know, we have to change and develop with the character. And it's just really fun to go back and look at the, you know, the origins of it. And
well, and to see what has stayed so much the same, you know, and, you know, this was new to both of us. So even though it's almost a century old at this point, it was fresh and new to our eyes. And I mean, I've certainly come away with a better appreciation for something I thought I appreciated already to an nth degree. But being able to, you know, add to that love and the mythos that we know about this character, just what a fantastic opportunity.
Yeah, I really did. I had a blast watching this. I can't wait to watch the next one. And when we do, you know, I think we're going to do like little sequels.
Yeah, we're going to run where
we
sequels.
Do all the sequels.
You bet, yeah.
And I can't wait to talk about the next one. I can't wait to see Lex Luthor.
It's a good Lex. It's a good Lex, you know.
Is it?
Yeah, well, and I mean, this we'll definitely get there. But what I think is funny is it harkens, well, of course, it harkens back to the classical Lex Luthor as mad scientist versus modern Lex Luthor, maniacal real estate investor. and it's just like, you know, I don't know. Is there genius in real estate schemes versus, you know, destructo rays? Come on now. I mean, let's get some classic Lex going again. Yeah. I think it's we've lost sight of Lex's origin and kind of being reminded about it in the beginning of this. Plus, there's an update to the special effects. There is an addition to the animation. There are flying shots, Kirk Allen flying. So,
oh, really?
To an effect.
So it's not animation.
There is, but then there's also, you know, an attempt to make it look like he's flying too.
Yeah, that's interesting. Camera I can't animals. Wait to see that. Yeah. Speaking of destructo rays, we kind of got off the plot here. To wrap up what happens with the reducer rays, they go back and forth a bunch of times. Lois gets kidnapped by the Spider Lady a few times. Jimmy gets in some trouble. Superman saves him. End of the day, they use the reducer ray on Spider Lady.
So, oh, yeah. She got reduced into her spider web. And you know, to you, dear readers, the reason why you just heard that from Josh is not because we couldn't go on and on and on and on about it, but literally that's what happens. It goes back and forth between who has the ray and who has the means to use the ray and how they're going to stop the ray and which one of Superman's pals is in trouble and which henchman is in charge of wrapping Lois in a carpet. They go there. They use the roll it up in a carpet. They roll the body in a carpet, which I thought was fantastic because, yeah. You know, just noni noni no out in the street, just stuffing a carpet down into a trunk and no big deal. But you're not, yeah, this story isn't about the story. This story is about its place in history. You know, it is every bit it's not a good movie. in that regard.
Well, and here's the thing. It's not a movie. You know, it's 15 episodes.
Right.
So they had to keep them coming back. Right. And the only way to do that was to put Lois in trouble or to put Jimmy in trouble. Or, you know. But when you're watching it as a film and you're not having to wait till next week, I mean, it does get a little repetitive. That would be my only critique.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it's unfair to critique it that way because that
it's not meant
to be to sit down and watch it. It was meant to be released, you know, weekly.
And that was one of the things about having it broken up through, you know, after I was able to get the episodes, having it broken up episodically. It did remind me of, oh, wow, this would have been the experience. And I would have been like, what would it be like to have to wait a week to find out what happens next? You know? And is Ma going to let me go to the show? You know?
Well, they all left on the cliffhanger.
Yeah.
So I'm sure the kids in 1948 were just like, what's going to happen next?
I better go shine up my nickel right now.
Just a couple things I wanted to mention just about the production. They actually did try to shoot him flying.
Mm-hmm.
And the director hired a completely other production crew to shoot these flying scenes. And they did one day of it. And Kirk Allen complained because the rigging was uncomfortable and it was like a painful day for him. And when the director got the dailies back, he fired the whole production team because he didn't like it. And that's when they decided to do the animation, which I thought was really funny.
Oh, I did. I read that. And I was like, yeah, man, I guess when it's time to cut bait, it's time to cut bait, you know?
Yeah.
If it looked that bad and the actor's that unhappy, you're just fighting an uphill battle.
I just think it's kind of funny because they didn't even try to do it again. He was just like, fuck it, we'll make an animation.
We'll fix it in post.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly what he said.
That's the first fix it in post ever. Screw that. Give me the cartoonist.
One of the other little funny things that I read was that they had a stuntman. Did you read this little tidbit?
Yeah, and he like broke his leg.
And on the first stunt.
Yeah, and he was like, I'm out, deuces.
And so that's kind of why I think the fight scenes got a little repetitive and Superman was doing the same thing to two henchmen every time is because they didn't have a stuntman.
This is what we could do to not hurt somebody. There was one bit I was watching, and like, I think it's Spider Lady or one of the henchmen. Oh no, it's when they're going to roll Lois up into the carpet. So the reason they have to roll her up is because they like chunked her across the room and she goes tumbling into the, desk and she knocks her head. But you can tell, like, it looks like a pretty awful, you know, go at it, but you can tell like right at the end that they had sped the footage up to make it happen faster. Because it does that too, that uncanny slowdown where then it's like the tumble's slower than the fall.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I noticed that they did that a lot, actually.
Especially when he was running or trying to run. They would speed up Superman just a little bit from time to time.
Just a little bit. Yeah.
That is one of those intentional choices to stretch what you've got and make the most of very little, knowing how to, you know, even just mediocrely play those kinds of effects to effect, help tell the story. You know, Superman moves a little bit faster than the rest of us because he's Superman, mm-hmm. you know, and just little bitty things like that. Sam Katzman, right? The director?
Yeah.
And he does the other one too.
And Thomas Carr. I think there were multiple directors.
Per episode?
Yeah, yeah.
But they did the titles in the traditional style with the 3D, you know, stretched Superman lettering and everything, man. This was maybe done for fun and profit, but also felt like someone who worked on this liked Superman a lot.
Yeah, and it comes across. You can really tell.
Yeah.
Well, buddy,
did we do it again?
We did it again. We talked about Superman.
Holy shit. It's becoming a regular habit. I don't know.
I like this habit. It's a good habit to have.
It is a good habit to have. You can never discuss too much Superman. But next time, we're going to have a special
guest. Next time on
I know.
Yeah. If everything works out to plan, which I don't see any reason why, you know, it won't.
We have 2 weeks to fuck it up.
Yeah. We have our very first guest coming on the show. Very excited to have him on. Jake Hood, is that his last name?
Yeah, Jake Hood. Uh-huh. He's Final Frontier 87 on Twitter.
Yeah, he is an uber Superman fan who has taught me a thing or two about Superman. And
which is
impressive. We're going to have him on to talk about George Reeves. So, yeah. You know, I'm going to have to, again, do some homework this week. Because I haven't seen very many episodes.
So keep in mind, young P, that any and all of the fundage you have to spend to support this project is technically a tax write-off. If you ended up having to pay for a little bit of Superman here and there, you know, keep the receipts. That's what I'm saying.
It's good to know.
You know, because we can run this at a loss for 5 years.
We probably will, but I had a blast with this, and I'm glad that we got to sit down and talk about this iteration of Superman. If you haven't seen these, I stress to you that you're going to have a great time.
You really
if
will.
You seek these out.
You really will.
It's just wholesome goodness, and if you love Superman, you're gonna love it. So,
the 1948, you know, Superman. It's just right there in the name, and yeah, I second all of that. Recommended highly. I mean, if you've gotten this far on this episode of the podcast, I surely hope that you have seen it by now.
Well, guys, we're gonna see you next week or the week after. We're gonna see you soon.
See you soon.
Trust me.
Yeah,
we're going to see you soon. And we're going to talk about George Reeves. Until then, you know, I think it's time for me to jump out the window and say up, up, and play. So,
yeah, man, keep your eyes to the skies.
See you later, Dan.
See you later, Josh.
Bye, guys. Thank you for listening to this episode of Josh, Dan, and Superman, a Trek Nerd podcast. If you like what you've heard and are feeling generous, why not head over to patreon.com/treknerd, that's TrekNurd, and click on the tier for our show. Remember, the more you contribute, the more sexually attractive you will be to the gender of your choice. That's just science, folks. All music for the show is provided by the immensely talented and exceptionally handsome Mr. Patrick Lee. He can be found on Spotify, Apple Music, or visit his website at patrickleemusic.org. Supporting independent artists like Dan, Patrick, and myself will guarantee longer, healthier lives. Again, that's just science. I'm Josh Paddock. We'll see you next time on Josh, Dan, and Superman.
Let me personally congratulate you on your completion of this achievement unit.